upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. Were included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And good day. This is Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. Today is April 30, 2019. Now, here's a really good story for you. How would you like to buy a bicycle and make that your primary mode of transportation from now on? Now, if you live in the country and have to travel 20 miles to the nearest store, that could be difficult. But if you live in a city, think of all the benefits. Why, you don't have to hire a garage to park your car. You don't have to spend a lot of money on gasoline and insurance, and all you need to do is just apply a little horsepower yourself to your own pedals, and away you go. And of course, when you get to your destination, you have to lock your bike up so nobody will steal it. Well, there's a new movement called sustainable mobility. Actually, it's not really new. It's quite old, but it's gaining steam. And a prediction has been made that by 2030... not very far away, that half of all city trips will be made by bicycle. That's correct. The article starts out, when the first bicycle mayor, a person who serves as a connecting point between city departments, nonprofits, and other bike advocates, was chosen in Amsterdam in 2016. The idea was to help an already bike-obsessed city to become even more bikeable. But the program was never intended only to be about Amsterdam. The nonprofit behind the idea aims to bring city bike mayors to 200 cities by the end of 2019. The program is already in 30 cities from São Paulo to Istanbul, and it's coming to a city near you. Now, this may seem a little strange to you, but this is connected to the original Agenda 21 document. The idea in cities was to displace cars and get people to ride bicycles, because that's more sustainable and it doesn't pollute the atmosphere as much with that evil carbon dioxide and other pollutants like that come from automobiles. And I want to read to you, just so you really understand that this is the case, from the original Agenda 21 document. I have the book in my hands right now. I paid $25 for it once upon a time. It's more now, but you can buy it on Amazon.com. Just search for Agenda 21, and you'll see a big orange book, or a book with an orange cover, come up. It's called the Earth Summit. You'll see the United Nations logos or symbols at the bottom. The one for UNEP is there as well. That's the United Nations Environmental Program that sponsored Agenda 21. And on page 60 of this document, we read the following. International organizations and bilateral donors should, point one, support developing companies in implementing national energy programs in order to achieve widespread use of energy-saving and renewable energy technologies, particularly the use of solar, wind, biomass, and hydro sources. Point two, provide access to research and development results to increase energy use efficiency in human settlements. That means cities, of course. Now, the next point gets into it. This is 7.52. Promoting efficient and environmentally sound urban transport systems in all countries should be a comprehensive approach to urban transport planning and management. To this end, all countries should, point A, integrate land use and transportation planning to encourage development patterns that reduce transport demand. B, adopt urban transport programs favoring high occupancy public transport in countries as appropriate. C, encourage non-motorized modes of transport by providing safe cycleways and footways in urban and suburban centers and countries. D. Devote particular attention to effective traffic management, efficient operation of public transport, and maintenance of transport infrastructure, which directly points back to the bike paths and walking paths. Now, this was the little stake that was set in the ground back in 1992 to move you out of your automobiles and onto your bicycle, providing your own personal means of transportation throughout the city. Now, some people obviously are in favor of that. They like their bicycles. They like to bike. I don't know how they do that in the wintertime when it's freezing cold or snowing or whatever, but, well, we can excuse those people that just like to ride their bike. But for the rest of the world, we probably don't want to be micromanaged and engineered into being forced to ride a bicycle in lieu of riding in a car or any other means of transportation for that matter. Well, so much for half of all city trips to be by bicycle by the year 2030. We'll see. The next story concerns regionalism. This is a story that I've been tracking for some time now, a few months anyway. It's a relatively new application of overarching social engineering. In this case, it has to do with the Smart Region Initiative. My headline is Regionalism, Smart Region Initiatives Overrule City Councils. Now, this story has brought to light the fact that utility companies are going to play an important part in smart city regions. This is not to say we're just forgetting about smart cities altogether, but the companies that are implementing smart city technology have come across a problem. Imagine that. They have a problem. The problem is city councils. Those pesky little elected officials who think that they have control and charge over the city that they're elected to serve in. Well, they ask too many questions. They ask for information, for details. They want to negotiate their own contracts with these large companies, and that simply is not acceptable for them. So the answer is set up smart region initiatives that will establish policy for an entire region, not just for a city, but for an entire region, and then force that entire region to adopt those policies without first really going through the city council process and the standard process for implementing anything within a city. Just bypass them. This first started happening in the Phoenix area. That's why I got alerted to it. And what's happening here is that a group of nonprofit organizations and Arizona State University have gotten together and simply declared themselves to be the Smart Region Initiative for our area. And they're putting together policies already to take to all the cities and saying, hey guys, this is the way we're going to do it. Some of the cities are already saying, no, that's not the way we're going to do it. We want to do it our way. And that's where the fun begins. Because the region says, you'll do it our way. The city says, no, we'll do it our way. And who's going to win? At this point, I can almost guarantee you the way that the smart region initiatives are being set up, they will win. This is a patently unconstitutional mechanism, governmental mechanism, that promotes and establishes regionalism as a form of government. That is, lording it over the cities within the regions. In the case of the Phoenix area, we have well over 4 million people in this area, some odd 20 plus cities, and the Smart Region Initiative is going to create policy for every one of these cities. And they'll like it or lump it, I'm afraid. In this case, in this article, it's noted that the utility companies are going to have a huge part to play in smart region initiatives. This does make sense in a way because utility companies typically span multiple cities and multiple counties. Sometimes they take up a whole state. And so the utility companies that already own infrastructure, like electrical poles and the electrical grid in general. All of these things can be used as a backbone for smart region initiatives. So if somebody from the smart region initiative goes and talks to a utility in your area, they will be in a position to make a deal with them to say, look, why don't you implement all of these smart city initiatives in your system, and we'll simply make it all available to the individual cities, and the individual cities won't have a whole lot to say about it. We already saw this happen with smart meters, by the way. When the smart meter initiative started back under President Obama in 2009, nobody asked for smart meters. Nobody wanted smart meters, really. There was no market for it, even though the meters had been around for several years. Nobody wanted them. But President Obama threw money at it, gave it to the utility company, said, hey, go out and install smart meters, do some pilot projects, and let's get this thing going. That's exactly how it got going. Money showed up, utility trucks rolled, smart meters were installed. In many cases, the consumers never even had a clue that there was a new meter on the side of their home or business. Just showed up. Well, they're in a position to do the same kind of railroading again. In this case, instead of smart meters showing up, you might well have a network of 5G transmitters show up. Just boom, they're there. Well, how did they get there? Well, the utility companies was contacted and contracted, and they just snuck them in and put them up and said, hey, those are our poles anyway. So get out. We can do whatever we want with our infrastructure. And the public will wonder, how did we get on the sideline here with this whole process? The Smart Region Initiative is being spread throughout America like wildfire. It started here in Phoenix. Cities across the nation have been watching what's happening here in Phoenix. We're hoping soon to be able to throw somewhat of a monkey wrench into the system. We'll see. If we have any success, I'll let you know. The last story is a follow-up on one posted a few weeks ago on Technocracy News, and it has to do with the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, there's a name that you probably didn't want to hear today, but the Rockefeller Foundation had previously had a very expensive program that they were bankrolling called 100 Resilient Cities. And this was an exercise around the world in improving resilience in cities. That's resilience to things like disasters and so on. But resilience is a program of the United Nations. That's one of their sustainable development goals, by the way, to make cities more resilient. So the Rockefeller Foundation took up the task. Some years ago, they created the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative, and away they went. Threw a lot of money at it, opened offices in different parts of the world, and then abruptly, a few weeks ago, they announced that they were closing down their 100 Resilient Cities, and instead, they were giving it over to the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council is another nonprofit organization, traditionally a think tank. But this is interesting. This article says now that we know this, we can see the details coming out. The Atlantic Council and Rockefeller Foundation, the article reads, announced the launch of the Adrian Arsht Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center. Now that's housed, mind you, within the Atlantic Council, which seeks to enhance the resilience of 1 billion people worldwide by 2030. It is the successor of 100 Resilient Cities, nicknamed 100RC, the Rockefeller Foundation's former resilience effort that is to be disbanded effective July 31. So just in a couple of months, the Rockefeller Foundation operation is going to shut down. It's been handed over to the Atlantic Council. The article continues, in addition to a $30 million grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, the new Resiliency Center received a $25 million gift from business leader and philanthropist Adrian Arsht. In a press conference at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., Arsht said the new center is part of her aim of, quote, improving the state of the world in measurable ways. To me, resilience is a way of thinking. It's how you behave and how you see the world, she said, adding that she hopes the initiative will become a global center for resilient solutions for people, systems, and institutions. The center's director, former Bank of America executive Kathy Bogman McLeod said the new initiative will be focused on 100% implementation, while 100RC was more focused on planning and building. She said it would look to use evidence-based solutions and best practices that can be copied at scale and help them encourage the partnership and financial backing such plans require. Now, I said at the time when this was first announced that the Rockefeller Foundation was disbanding 100 resilient cities, I indicated that the plan was hardly dead. And if anything, it was being put on turbocharge. And now we see that's exactly what's happening. The Atlanta Council has taken the program, they've expanded it, gotten more money to fund it, and they're taking it to the next level. That's all. So whatever type of a handshake deal was originally made with the Atlantic Council, I want you to know that these two organizations have been closely linked since at least 1973 when the Trilateral Commission was formed by David Rockefeller. Back in that day when Professor Anthony Sutton and myself wrote Trilaterals Over Washington in two volumes, we wrote a lot about the Atlantic Council and how they were fundamentally involved with the Trilateral Commission's goal for setting or establishing a new international economic order. I looked down the membership list of the board of directors of Atlantic Council, and I see basically nothing except global elite, global elite, global elite, many of whom are members of the Trilateral Commission even to this day, by the way. There's quite a few directors. They meet, they vote, they direct the organization, they promote the organization as well. But just some of the people that I see on the list, I'll just read a few names. Brent Scowcroft is one. He's chairman emeritus. He was a member of the Trilateral Commission. Stephen Hadley, Robert Abernathy, Walter Slocum, H.R. McMaster, Dennis Blair, lots of people from the intelligence community here. Philip Breedlove, Joseph Nye, not only a member of the commission, he's also the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Michael Chertoff, remember him. Wesley Clark, David Petraeus, lots of military people here too. Dina Powell, Paula Dobriansky, Paula Stern, Henry Kissinger. There's a name you recognize. Now, it's interesting to note, this is a point you just have to see. All of the names that I just read on the membership list here of the board of directors come from the right side of the political aisle, not the Democrat side. These people are mostly identified with the Republican Party. Now, lest you think that there is some political ideology behind sustainable development, you need to dispel those thoughts, because there's not. It has survived and ridden on the back of Republicans as well as Democrats ever since it was started. This was, in fact, the nature of the Trilateral Commission when it was formed in 1973. We examined the membership in detail, and we found out that the Rockefeller core crowd had brought people in from both sides of the political spectrum to create this new international economic order, which was technocracy. We know that today. But this new international economic order was not to be defined by anyone as a political movement of the right or the left. It completely transcends it. And people who are looking at the left-right divide today, whether it be in the political system of our country or in the functioning of these programs like 100 Resilient Cities, these programs have no political ideology. Technocracy is the ideology. So here we have a major right-of-center think tank policy organization, the Atlantic Council, taking a major part in the world of sustainable development by sponsoring, developing, and promoting the 100 Resilient City program all over the planet in conjunction with the United Nations. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. Have a great day.